Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. When you're a Nobel laureate, aka a super successful scientist, people will often ask you,
how did you make your discovery?
They want you to get
to the exciting part.
You know, don't tell me about all of the time you spent rolling that boulder up the hill. Cut to the chase.
You can't say to them, well, you see, I was working for many years on an animal that was transparent.
Columbia neuroscientist Martin Chalfie says this long version matters. So here it goes. He was studying the sense of touch using tiny translucent worms.
Which meant, because it's only a millimeter long, that I took an eyebrow hair, glued it to a toothpick, and tickled the worms.
Eventually, he got mutant worms that couldn't sense touch.
We cloned those genes, and that's a whole big story of how we did that.
All right, we're not going to get into that. But after working on worms for about a decade, he attended a seminar on bioluminescent organisms, think jellyfish, and he heard about what makes them glow, green fluorescent protein. And it hit him. He could use these proteins, get them into his worms, and light up some of the processes he was trying to study.
I'm going to see where those genes are active. It's going to be in our transparent animal.
And that's what he eventually got the Nobel Prize for in chemistry, together with Osamu Shimomura and Roger Tsien, for the discovery and development of the green fluorescent protein. Usually, Martin sums up the whole story more like this.
We put it into the worms and it worked.
But he says by jumping right to the success, you're leaving out what came before, which includes failure, lots of failures.
We don't talk about how people work out things.
How to problem solve, how to keep going when you're feeling totally defeated, or how to ask for help. It paints a wrong picture of how science works. Martin says as a young undergrad at Harvard, working in a lab, he thought that scientists never failed.
I had this idea that I needed to prove myself, and proving myself meant not asking for help and not asking questions.
All of his experiments failed miserably.
And I took that as an absolute indication that I should not be a scientist, because scientists are the people that succeed at these things. It made me abandon the idea completely.
After graduating, Martin started working as a teacher. It was only by total chance, through a summer job, that he returned to a lab. There, he had some good experiences, and he went back to grad school. And now, from his Nobel laureate perch, he wants to spread the gospel of failure. In science and life, failure is both a stumbling block and a building block. We loathe, fear, and avoid failure. We feel ashamed when it happens. But it's also often a necessary learning experience. On today's episode, failure, how we talk about it and cope with it. More and more colleges are starting conversations about failure. I met up with Martin Chalfie right after he gave a big talk on this issue at Columbia's Teachers College. It was a kickoff for a whole series. And universities all over the country are doing events like that, where people share their struggles and epic fails and how they got back up and moved on. It's part of an effort to get students to ask for help rather than give up when failures happen. Alan Yu has more.
Natalie Balkan was a PhD student, earning her doctorate in business and consumer behavior. But standing in her way was statistics.
I was feeling really confident about the exam. And then when I got in there, I just broke down in the middle of the exam and just started screaming like, this is not what I studied. And I just started crying in the middle of the exam. I ended up getting a D on it, like a high D. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get thrown out of my PhD program. And it's going to be because I can't seem to conquer the statistics.
In the middle of her worries about the future, she shared her fears. She talked to her friends who understood statistics and spent time with them outside class. And that's how she got help. Here's Angela Giordano's story. She'd played field hockey since 7th grade. She loved it and made it onto her college team, practiced for hours, 5 days a week, but then got cut.
It was like embarrassing. I played on this team for 2 years. Why am I not good enough now? It was awful. It's like hard to describe, but the feeling is so memorable to me. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, I don't sit with you at dinner anymore. Like, we would sit every night after practice at dinner together. Like, we'd get a table, it'd be the field hockey table. And that's what every sports team kind of did.
But now she wasn't on a sports team anymore. Angela felt lost. She called her parents. She called her high school coach.
In those moments, like, just following it was really painful and really hard to talk about and not something I really wanted to acknowledge.
But that's what helped her move on.
I think I felt better about it rather than letting it just kind of hide away or be something that was like eating at me.
A couple of years after those failures, both of them are doing fine. Natalie Balcom is now Dr. Natalie Balcom, a professor of marketing. Angela found a passion for public health. She's now a health promotion specialist. They both shared their experiences on stage at Bentley University in Massachusetts, just outside Boston.
You're going to have the opportunity to hear from some amazing panelists who are willing to be vulnerable and share their stories of failure.
The whole event celebrated failure. It's part of that movement to encourage college students to get comfortable talking about failures as they happen, and ultimately to get people help when they really need it. There's a similar push in the science world to share recent failures. Biologist and science writer Maryam Zering-Helem is making that argument. Her failure story starts a few years ago when she was a molecular biology student. She had this big idea for her PhD. How is it that all the cells in our body have the same DNA blueprint yet turn out so different? The lab work could get pretty tedious.
On my computer, writing code, growing up cells, like billions and billions of cells. Billions and billions of cells.
It basically looks like these liter flasks of red fluid and extract all of their RNA from them, send it off in a vial.
She did this 5 to 6 days a week. In 2013, her third year of doing this work, something happened. She came home from dinner and sat down to read a scientific journal.
As I'm reading, I start to notice, hey, this is exactly what it was that I wanted to study. My advisor sent me an email and said, oh, no.
Another scientist had beat her to it. Her advisor was reading the exact same paper Maryam was reading.
She was also panicking. It meant that I was kind of out of a research project and had to regroup 3 years into my PhD. That was really upsetting because I'd put 3 years at that point into trying to ask this question, and it seemed like somebody else had answered it already and had answered it quite well.
That was difficult to accept.
I had a really hard time getting out of bed. I had a really hard time trying to read the research papers that I should have been reading to get more ideas. I didn't see my friends very much.
But her advisor stepped in and told Maryam to take some time off to regroup.
My advisor said that I wasn't going to come up with any new and good ideas when I was really sad and when I was kind of kicking myself for not being faster.
A few months later, she went back to work. She came up with a new plan to build on the work that the other research teams had done and suggested improvements. Not quite the big, bold leap for science she had envisioned, but still a step forward. She submitted and got her PhD. She says talking about her failure back then, in that low moment, was really valuable. And she thinks there's value beyond just the person. It can help people get a clear and accurate picture of what scientists do and what they go through.
Scientists aren't used to talking about our emotions and our vulnerability. It's a space that's very different for us because your emotions don't get you grant money. Your emotions don't get you funders. Your emotions don't get you your next publication.
Maryam says failure is part of science. It's part of the nature of what you do. And talking about it would only be an improvement for the field.
And I think that we're really doing ourselves a disservice as scientists by not talking about those fresh failures. Because I think that people start to see how devastated a scientist can be after a failure. But that because they love science so much, because we're so passionate about the questions that we're asking, we will eventually come back with the optimism that the next time we do an experiment, it might work out.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. And Alan, failure is sort of having a moment right now. There are these universities that are starting up conversations about failure. And also scientists are trying to bring more attention to the fact that mistakes happen in science and also in research publications, right?
Yes. So one example of that is something called the Loss of Confidence Project, which a group of psychologists started. And the idea is for them to take a look at their old work and tell people, you know, this doesn't really hold up anymore. And it speaks to the idea that the whole point of science is to learn new things. I talked to cognitive scientist Chris Chabris. He's behind that project.
As a scientist, you are known and judged on your body of published work. So admitting that there are cracks or flaws in it, might be difficult, especially for some people. So we really wanted to sort of provide a social impetus to show people that it's okay.
Chris shared one of his early research papers where he did something that scientists call p-hacking. Basically, it means you crunch the numbers until you get the results that you want. And his team collected 10 more examples from researchers who were willing to take a look at their old work more critically. And not all of them are tenured professors with secure jobs.
So is the thinking, if we get some people to share mistakes they have made and discuss them publicly, maybe others will follow suit?
That's right. And so his vision is that maybe the science journals will have a section for something like this, kind of a forum where researchers can learn from each other's mistakes sooner.
We didn't want sort of deathbed confessions. We wanted active researchers to talk about this and to say what they had lost confidence in.
And the hope is that this will bring about a different process, one where scientists feel free to say, I don't think this result really holds up.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks, Maiken.
Generally speaking, scientists publicly reviewing their own work, finding their own mistakes, that doesn't happen. Very few people want to shine a giant spotlight on their own failures. So who's out there looking for bad science? Meet a guy who's been nicknamed the data thug, James Heathers.
I hope I come across as sufficiently intimidating to live up to that.
Yes, you sound very intimidating.
Oh, thank you very much for saying that.
James is a biosignals researcher at Northeastern University in Boston in the Computational Behavioral Science Lab. That's his day job, but in his spare time, together with other scientists, James looks for mistakes and inconsistencies in research studies. Can you venture a guess how much of the research that we're consuming on a daily basis has problems in it?
That really depends on what you mean by problems. If you mean really serious problems, not that much. Estimates for all forms of serious misconduct and for serious mistakes are all somewhere in the low single figures. For normal inconsistencies, it's a lot higher, but it's also a lot harder to determine.
Normal inconsistencies are things like human and machine errors, old equipment breaking down, files being lost, mistakes made when measurements are taken or coded, all of which leads to having incomplete or incorrect data. As for major problems, here's an example. The people James collaborates with found many of them in some research that came out of Cornell University from a really successful and popular scientist, Brian Wansink.
They didn't find one or two. They found 150.
And this is a scientist who has done a lot of research on nutrition, right? On the size of plates and the color of plates and where your toaster is located, that kind of stuff?
Yep, absolutely. Toaster location dynamics.
We had Brian Wansink on The Pulse a few years ago.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Philadelphia.
How are you?
yeah, cool.
And sure enough, we talked about toasters.
Make sure there isn't a toaster in your counter. We did this really cool study called the Syracuse study because we went into 230 households in Syracuse and took pictures of everything they had and weighed the family. We found that the average family that has a toaster sitting out anywhere in the kitchen, the male of the household will weigh 8 pounds more than the daddy next door.
Why?
Well, I think it's largely because it makes bread so attractive. It's like, you know, I wasn't really thinking of bread, but toast. You know, that's a different story.
Since then, 17 of Brian Wansink's papers have been retracted. He no longer teaches at Cornell, but he says he stands by his work. I asked James Heathers how this kind of thing happens. I'm wondering, though, how does the scientific community fail to detect such errors? These papers were published. They got a lot of attention. It seemed legit, right?
Well, I think he's a very good presenter, and I think he's extremely personable, and he speaks about his research with a lot more dynamism than I can usually muster. It's on face value, I think it's very interesting to people. Your question was like, how did this thrive?
Yes.
And the answer is really simple. Peer review is not designed to detect whether or not numbers exist in the first place. I give you a marvelous example of this. If we have children in a room and we give them all 20 jelly beans and they all eat an average of 8, the average of what is left behind is 12. It's maths that you learn in primary school. Those numbers in this paper were of that level of simplicity. None of the numbers were consistent. Now, when I found that paper, 1,100 people had downloaded and read that paper over a period of about a decade. And no one pointed out the fact that the primary school maths didn't add up. That is how antithetical to accuracy that peer review and what we can call post-publication review can be.
Why do you think these mistakes happen in the first place? Because I don't think, and I don't want to assume, that people set out to do bad science and to put shoddy work out there.
I think in general, there are an enormous amount of people in science who are swimming furiously upstream, just trying to keep body and soul together as they are turning their work into publications and turning their publications into careers. It's very hard to be incredibly accurate, incredibly fast. And science increasingly, as a profession, demands speed.
So is there a way that the field of science could embrace the concept of failures more as part of the process, the good and the bad and all the mishaps and mistakes that happen?
I would absolutely love that. I think it should be okay to say, either publish something on top of my paper that expresses concern, or retract my paper until I can fix it, or help me change this. I would like it if you could put a note on your own paper that says, I have lost confidence in this result. Will someone come and help me actually solve the problem? You absolutely should be allowed to make a mistake and then go out, own it, and fix it. But the idea of, I need to put as many published items in order as possible, is not really congruent with that.
James Heathers is a biosignals researcher at Northeastern University in Boston, and in his free time, he tracks down mistakes in studies and papers. So I moved my toaster for nothing.
I think you should probably go and put that toaster back.
All right. We're talking about failure, how we deal with it, what we can learn from it. Medical school is tough, competitive, exhausting, and expensive, which means the stakes are high. Liz Tung has the story of a student who faced failure and came up with an innovative solution.
It was the second round of med school applications for Percy Tatchy. He had applied to a dozen schools the year before and didn't get into any of them. So in the spring of 2017, when he got an email from one of the schools he applied to, he was expecting a big, fat no.
And I'm reading the words and I'm seeing all the positive words, all, you know, sorts of great words. I'm like, wait, hold on. Like, are they going to accept me? And then at the bottom, they're like, oh, here is the award package. And I was in disbelief. I just started crying, like just tears of joy.
It was a huge moment for Percy. He decided in college that he wanted to be a doctor. It's sort of the family business. His brother's a doctor, his mom a nurse, and he liked the idea of service. But there was something else driving Percy. A few years before, while Percy was still in college, his mom had been diagnosed with an aggressive form of cancer. Percy says visiting his mom in the hospital during the last year of her life helped cement his drive to become a doctor.
I got to see different physicians who would care for her. And I saw some really great ones and I saw some really bad ones. And I think just seeing that, wow, like, although these people are doctors, not every doctor is a great doctor. You know, I want to be able to go into this field and help reshape it or kind of help change the landscape.
Even after Percy's mom died, that determination stuck with him. It kept him going through a whole extra year of pre-med classes and then two more years of working full time while studying for his MCATs, the notoriously tough admissions test for medical students, all the way to the fall of 2017, which is when Percy started his first year at PCOM, the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Percy says he went in confident. Well, sort of.
I mean, I was scared. I'll be honest, I was scared, but I did think I was just going to come in and kill it.
Percy had always been a smart guy, and he knew how to work hard. But like a lot of med students, he wasn't prepared for the sheer volume of material he had to learn each and every week.
They give this analogy that medical school is like taking a fire hose, sticking it in your mouth, and just turning it on full blast. That's how much information you're getting.
That first trimester, Percy had three main classes. He was doing well in the first two, but the third one, an anatomy course, was just so much information. They got tested on it every 2 weeks, which was daunting enough. But there was something else that made this class especially scary.
If you do not pass it, then unfortunately you have to retake over the whole year.
Let me repeat that. This class is so important that if you fail, you essentially have to drop out for the rest of the year and start over from scratch the following fall. It only took a couple exams for Percy to realize that failing the class was a real risk. He'd never had to learn this much stuff in his life. It was completely overwhelming. But Percy didn't ask for help. He felt like he had to figure this out on his own. And the worse he did, the more isolated he became.
Kind of felt like it was, like in a snowball just rolling down the hill and it keeps building up. It was just downhill, and it was hard for me to come back from the hole that I had dug myself in.
Soon, Percy's fear of failure started affecting his studies.
And it would just keep coming to my head. What's going to happen if I don't pass?
What would he do if he failed? How would he tell people?
I didn't know what life was going to be like after I didn't pass, you know? Even just having that conversation in the hallways, you see people are prepping for the next class. You're like, oh, hi, you know, just to let you know, I didn't pass this course.
There was also a more practical concern. Percy had paid for his tuition, along with his housing, his bills, his textbooks, using financial aid money. And he knew that loan money was contingent on his being enrolled in school.
I just didn't even know how I was going to live, where I was going to live, if I was going to have money for that. And I was scared, not knowing how to approach having that conversation with professors to not seem as though I had given up.
For Percy, that's how taboo the idea of failing was. He needed help, but he couldn't bring himself to discuss the possibility with his professors, even at the risk of facing potential homelessness.
I think a lot of there's still shame associated with struggle.
Stuart Slavin's whole job is to study well-being among med students. He used to be a med school dean and now works at the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, the organization responsible for accrediting med schools. And Stuart says medical students are especially vulnerable to the shame and stigma associated with academic failure.
If you reveal to others that you're struggling, people will think you're weak, that you're not as tough as everybody else.
Stuart says that competitiveness and the intense fear of failure that it brings is part of the culture at medical school. He says that's partly because a lot of programs have unrealistic expectations and partly because of the students themselves.
They view performance as identity, many of them, right? So they don't see themselves as, oh, I got this test score. It's I am this test score.
What makes things worse is that according to Stuart, those thoughts can lead to some really serious problems. Studies show that medical students have depression and anxiety at rates as much as 3 to 5 times higher than the general public. And that can lead to a vicious cycle. Fear of failure leads to anxiety and depression. Anxiety and depression can disrupt students' lives, leading them to actually fail. So how do you break this cycle? To find out, I turned to Angela Duckworth. She's a psychology researcher at the University of Pennsylvania, better known as the author of the book Grit.
You know, what I notice about gritty women and men across different fields is that there is a kind of underlying confidence about what they are going to be capable of at some point. I don't think it's the same thing as arrogance about what they are currently capable of today. In fact, I think actually knowing what you can't do is important because with gritty individuals, they're just always learning and improving.
It's what psychologists call a growth mindset. Basically, the belief that you can get better, smarter, more skilled by challenging yourself. Its opposite is the fixed mindset, which says ability is innate. You either have it or you don't. What distinguishes the two is how they react to failure. People with fixed mindsets see it as evidence that they don't have what it takes and never will. People with growth mindsets, on the other hand, are more likely to embrace failure, to see it as an opportunity to learn and improve. Angela says it helps to think of your life as a story, your narrative.
The idea is not to tell a perfect story. The idea is not even to tell like the best possible story, just to tell a story, one possible story that you can be proud of. And if I were a medical student who had just failed my first year, I would certainly say this is a really, you know, grim chapter, right? It's a low point in the narrative. Like, let's not kid ourselves. But I would think about it as like, okay, what happens next in this story? And we've all read enough stories and listened to enough stories to know that, you know, the greatest people alive have had those chapters.
For Percy, that chapter became real when he received his grades for the first trimester. It was the moment of truth. Had he passed his anatomy class or not?
And I ended up with a 68% and you needed a 70.
2 points off. It was pretty tough to take. But it wasn't the disaster Percy had thought it would be. He found out he could hold on to his financial aid by continuing to take supplementary classes until fall arrived, and he was able to start his first year over again. It could have been a grim 9 months, but instead, Percy decided to make something productive out of it. He started working out, reconnected with friends, figured out which study methods worked best for him. And he even started thinking about failure differently.
In order to get to where we want to get to, we are going to have failures. Failures lead us into success.
That's how Percy decided to launch his own podcast. Behind the White Coat, Failure and Perseverance. Get it?
What's going on, folks? It feels great to be back, man. This past trimester was a rough one.
So far, Percy's mostly interviewed other med students. He talks about his failures, they talk about theirs.
And then when I took STEP, yeah, it was probably my darkest time in medical school because that was
how they dealt with it, what they learned from it, and how they eventually muddled through to the other side. Percy says hearing other people's stories and thinking about his own has already helped.
And hope that when people start to see that, oh, wow, all these people who are doing all of these wonderful things, they went through a whole bunch of trials and tribulations. You know, they had a whole bunch of failures. And it would allow other people to open up and share their stories and make other people not discouraged to keep pushing forward.
That's how Percy imagines his own story will go. He went back to school in the fall of 2018, back to his first trimester and the anatomy class that he didn't pass. And this time, he confronted his weaknesses head on. For instance, he figured out that flashcards helped him target the material he knew the least, and that living a balanced life was ultimately better for his academics than all-night cram sessions. So far, it seems to have worked. He passed that anatomy class, and now he's in his third trimester. But he says school is still really hard, and his fear of failure hasn't gone away. The difference is now, instead of imagining every detail of his own failure, he tries to keep the faith that eventually he'll succeed. For The Pulse, I'm Liz Tung.
You can persevere behind the white coat, failure and perseverance. Now you the one that's in the driver's seat, the one that's steering. Bumps in the road, you learn to pass them by. If you learn from your mistakes, there's no limits to the sky. Now, take this journey with student doctor, persevere. Let's go.
We're talking about failure, how we cope with it, and how we can learn from it.
A new documentary called Right to Fail looks at an ambitious effort to give New Yorkers with severe mental illness the chance to live independently in what's called supported housing.
It was a landmark ruling. Thousands of New Yorkers with severe mental illness had a right to live on their own.
There was a huge question about whether people that have been institutionalized can live successfully in the community.
And a right to fail.
They just brought me there and said, ta-da, this is your apartment.
Frontline and ProPublica examined the challenges and the risks.
My brother was found totally naked. Was he taking his medication? Was he not taking his medication? What was going on?
Steph Yin looked into Right to Fail and some of the issues around supported housing that are covered in the documentary, and she's here now to talk more. Hey, Steph.
Hey, Megan.
So, Steph, what is supported housing, and ideally, what should it look like?
So how it works is that people would get their own apartment, and someone from a social service agency was supposed to come check on them a few times a week. But for the most part, people had the freedom to run their own errands, cook their own meals, and go about their days as they wanted.
So it was supposed to be less restrictive, but people still had support.
Yes, in theory.
So what happened?
So what the investigation found was that for many people, this setup worked just fine. Some people even flourished. They built their own lives and their own friend networks. But there were other people for which the setup didn't work so well. I talked to Joaquin Sapien, who investigated this for ProPublica.
Many of these people had lived in institutions for, you know, decades, for their entire adult life. They had never lived on their own, and they became accustomed to having a lot of things done for them, laundry, being fed, calls to take your medication, things like that.
So Joaquin's team looked into what happened to some of the people who moved out of adult homes into their own apartments, and they found more than 24 cases where the system totally fell through and people ended up getting seriously hurt or even dying.
One of the people that we focused on in our story is a guy named Abraham Clemente, who lived in his own apartment for less than a year, and it really devolved very quickly into a squalid situation. I mean, the whole apartment was alive with insects.
Abraham also accidentally started 2 fires in his kitchen, and ultimately he ended up back in the group home.
So this didn't work out for him and for others. I looked at the documentary and they also talked to a man named Nestor Bunch.
Yes. Nestor has severe schizophrenia. He has trouble telling his hallucinations from reality. And he's pretty much lived under some form of supervision his entire adult life.
And he moved into one apartment, wound up having a suicide attempt, was then moved in with a roommate who his caregivers thought might be able to take care of him. He found that roommate naked and dead in the foyer of their shared apartment building.
So that roommate had died of hypothermia.
And what happened to Nestor after that?
So Nestor was really traumatized by that. Afterwards, he moved a couple more times and was ultimately found in another apartment, injured within an inch of his life. His doctor suspected he had been brutally beaten up, possibly by his roommate.
And even after all of that, the state wanted to keep him in his own place. And so what we saw was that there was an effort to kind of keep people in their own apartments once they'd moved, no matter what.
So there were deaths, there were injuries. This documentary is called Right to Fail. Why this title? Why not just straight up failure?
Right to fail is a term used by advocates and people working in the field of supported housing to convey that these people should have the freedom to live like anyone else in the least restrictive setting with adequate supports. And that includes the freedom to try things that might lead to failure. So I talked about that with Tony Lisicki, executive director of the Association for Community Living.
Most of us in the mental health world believe that people should be given enough space to take risks, because after all, nobody really moves forward in their lives unless they take some risk.
Tony represents nonprofits from around New York State that provide supported housing to people with mental illness. They're called housing providers.
When somebody moves out of their parents' home, they're taking a risk. When they change jobs, they take a risk. When somebody moves out of an institutional setting into an independent apartment, they're taking a risk. There is no doubt about it. And a person with a serious mental illness is probably feeling more anxious than most about a step like that. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't allow them to do it and we shouldn't support them in doing it.
Tony says that the vast majority of people who move out of adult homes into supported housing do just fine. But she acknowledges that there are people who fall through the cracks. She thinks the system needs better ways to detect when someone's illness starts to deteriorate.
So what are they going to do better in New York? How would they catch somebody before they totally deteriorate?
Yeah, so one of the things that stood out to the reporter, Joaquin, was that there are so many players involved in the system. You have the state, the housing provider, the social service agencies, the individual workers who are underpaid and burnt out. And the lines of communication and accountability between these people aren't very clear. Until recently, the state didn't even have an incident tracking system. All that leads to people pointing fingers instead of taking action when something goes wrong. Part of the solution seems to be just consolidating and clarifying who's responsible for what.
Has there been any reaction on a government level to this documentary at all?
Yes. After the documentary aired, a federal judge ordered an investigation of the quality controls of supported housing. So everyone's waiting for those results now. And both Joaquin and Tony agree that the entire system is totally underfunded and desperately needs more money to work properly.
Thank you, Steph. The documentary is called Right to Fail. It's a collaboration between Frontline and ProPublica, and we'll put a link on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. So what makes a failure? I guess it depends on who you ask and what metric you're using in your evaluation. Money, popularity, scientific achievement. Sometimes you get one, but not the other. Lindsay Lazarski has this example from the world of technology.
Have you ever heard of the RCA video disc? No? That's fine. Most people haven't.
No. What's that?
No.
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 What? RCA is a recording company?
All right, here's the backstory.
Bring the magic home with RCA.
The RCA video disc was a short-lived entertainment format developed by the Radio Corporation of America, and it was essentially a way to store a video on a record, on a vinyl record.
That's technology historian Ben Gross from the Linda Hall Library in Kansas City. He has a collection of these things and brought one with him.
The one that's in my hand right now is a movie called Star Wars. You might have heard of it. It's about the size of a regular LP.
And it's encased in a protective sleeve.
If you were to play this, you would not actually take the record out yourself with your hands because the grooves are so small that you might end up getting dirt or dust or something else into them, and then the record wouldn't play right.
The disc is encased in a protective sleeve and can only be removed by the player, so your hands never touch it, and it won't be damaged.
So instead, you would put it into your video disc player, which you'd have hooked up to your TV, kind of like a DVD player or a VCR. You would kind of slide it in, it would click, you'd pull out the sleeve, and the disc would stay inside the player.
Can bring not just sound, but sound and pictures, clear, beautiful pictures, right into your living room.
To build this analog system, engineers had to figure out a way to cram all the information of a feature-length film, sound, images, color, into the grooves of a record.
And you would read it with a needle, in this case a diamond stylus with a metal electrode at the bottom.
Each side of the disc could hold an hour of a movie, and then you had to flip it to the other side. Engineers and scientists at RCA began developing this technology in the 1960s, after color television had become a hit. At that time, the only way to watch a film in the comfort of your own home was if you had a projector and a screen.
RCA was always interested in coming up with the next big electronic breakthrough. So they started thinking to themselves, what sort of thing would be a good follow-up product? And one technology that jumped out was some sort of home video player.
Engineers had a couple of different technologies that could serve as the basis for this system. Magnetic tape, like in a VCR, or a laser-based system in DVDs. But they ended up going with what they knew, vinyl.
It was easy to mass produce them. They had a lot of experience making records, and they could stamp them out pretty quickly once they figured out how to actually encode the information inside the grooves. Then it was relatively straightforward compared to making a tape-based system, and it was less expensive than something that used lasers.
RCA released the Videodisc in 1981 with a splash.
Live from NBC Studios in New York City, RCA presents The Year With Our Name On It.
Good evening, and welcome to NBC Studio 8H. I'm Tom Brokaw, NBC News, and tonight we are going to be part of an historic event in the home entertainment industry.
RCA's chairman, Edgar Griffiths, said the company invested more in the video disc than it had in black and white or color television.
In our judgment, this will be the most dramatic and important consumer product since the introduction of color.
But it wasn't. It was a massive flop. There were several problems with the video disc.
The biggest one being the timing of its release.
By the time the video disc was released, VHS was already on the market, and it could do something the video disc couldn't: record your favorite program or sports game and watch it later. Laserdiscs were also entering the field. Then there was a new and emerging business model that RCA hadn't anticipated: rentals. The company assumed that people would have video disc collections just like they did record collections. Today, many of us have VCRs and DVD players collecting dust in our basements, not video disc players. They just never took off.
Well, that is one of the most tragic parts of the story, is that RCA spent an enormous amount of money to make this happen. In the end, when they decided in 1984 to kind of wind down video disc production, the total loss was calculated at around $580 million. It was a significant enough loss that the company was put into financial peril. And by 1986, they were bought out by General Electric. This was the last great consumer electronics product that RCA ever tried to release.
But despite its commercial defeat, Ben says the ingenuity of the video disc is a reminder that the line between success and failure isn't always so clear-cut.
From a technical perspective, the video disc is a remarkable technology. Right? Figuring out how to take all of the video and audio information from a two-hour-long movie and put it within the grooves of a vinyl record, that is a very difficult technical achievement. And the fact that RCA scientists and engineers were able to figure out how to do that, and not only how to do that, but how to turn it into a commercially viable product, is extremely impressive. At the same time, technical brilliance doesn't necessarily translate into commercial success. So here was a technology that was, for a variety of reasons, not able to eke out a market share and ultimately was consigned to oblivion.
That science historian Ben Gross and Lindsay Lizarski reported that story. So failure is in the eye of the beholder. The framework matters. A few years ago, I hung out with some very special humans who don't care if they fail. In fact, that's pretty much all they do all day long, and they seem to be undeterred by it. Let's listen back. 10 months old, Henry Bechtel wants nothing more than to put his little hands on my microphone, but he just can't get there, try as he might to stand up. Mitch. Olivia Saltzman is a year and a half, Mitch. And she's having a terrible time trying to put colorful rings on wooden stakes. There goes the whole thing, falling on the floor. Olivia and I were also experiencing a pretty serious failure to communicate.
Push.
What's that?
Paste.
Finally, she holds up a tiny plastic object which belongs to one of her princess dolls.
Push.
Oh, purse.
And she just doesn't seem to care.
Push.
That's because at this precious age, from birth to about 18 months, kids only feel the primary emotions.
Joy and sadness and anger and fear and disgust and one other, which is surprise.
Catherine Dalsgaard is a psychologist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she says that limited range of emotions means blissful ignorance.
Children are busy, busy, busy in the first year of life, trying to learn how to talk and how to walk and how to use fine and gross motor skills and how to have their movements correspond to what their brain is saying to do. So basically, the first year of life is about learning to walk the walk and talk the talk. So they don't have time or the capacity to know how they are in relation to others and to judge themselves in relation to others, all of those things.
Think about it. How would you learn to crawl, stand, walk, or talk if you were secretly wondering why Hudson over there can already get up the steps even though he was born 2 months after you? Or why little Ella with her perfect hair is already forming three-word sentences? Show off. Dalsgaard says that all of those more complex emotions, envy, jealousy, pride, the baggage perhaps, all that comes later, around 2 years of age.
They are called the social emotions. It means that the child has developed the capacity to understand herself in relation to others.
And once kids understand the concept of achievement and failure on a more complex level, parents play an important role in framing how they deal with setbacks. And Dalsgaard says many overdo it, big time.
Grown-ups are blabbermouths. A child fails and it's, oh, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Don't worry, it's just a mistake. Oh, it's okay if it's not perfect. We can give you a new piece of paper. Look, you can draw it again. And the message that children get from that is, oh my gosh, my failure has made my mother anxious. Look at how much she is trying to correct it or fix it or soothe it. It must be a big deal.
Instead, Dalsgaard encourages parents to allow failure to happen. And if nobody's heard, give your child space to deal with it.
Feeling distress is a normal and important part of growing up.
And being able to deal with that distress and move on, Dalsgaard says that's what's going to count in the long run.
There's a lot of research that says the better you are at regulating your emotions, the ability to soothe yourself, the ability to put the painful event that just happened to you into perspective and then choose how to express your emotions about that is one of the main predictors of adult success.
So dealing with kids' failure is yet another thing parents can fail at. And that's not all. Researchers have also found that how parents praise their children's successes impacts how kids will deal with future challenges. Praising behaviors rather than making glowing blanket statements. So nice work drawing that elephant rather than, oh, wow, you're the best artist ever. That seems to help kids develop a healthy attitude toward learning new skills and potential failure. I'm only happy when it rains. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Julian Harris is our intern. We had help producing this week's episode from Joseph Fridman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Lindsay Lazarski is our producer, Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.